Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Hello, this is Garrett.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Can anybody hear me? Hello? Elise? Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you. Garrett was on.
Okay.
I heard him.
Okay, hold on here.
Hello, this is Garrett.
Hello, Garrett. Okay, let's get going here. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to today's show. In this podcast, we have the honor and the privilege of interviewing Mr. Gary Stanley. He is a senior information security engineer at a very leading cybersecurity firm called Virtual Armor, based in, or at least his office is based in Colorado. Garrett, thank you for your time this morning, and it's really a privilege to talk to you.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, well, first of all, we looked up your bio, and you seem to have a very rich and deep background in cybersecurity. Could you tell us some of the highlights of your career, please, like kind of what got you started in this area?
Yeah, you know, I've always had a rather large passion for IT ever since I was a kid. So like a lot of folks, kind of started at the bottom and have slowly just kind of worked my way up and got those good old fancy shiny degrees and certifications, but you know, really when it comes down to it, especially IT security, nothing quite beat experience. So just over the years, I've been trying to collect as much as I can of that. And the last few years been working here at Virtual Armor, just sort of finding my place on the front lines here for IT security.
Okay. Well, what kind of certifications do you have? What kind of certifications do you have?
I carry certifications from the IT side and everything from Apple's and Microsoft certifications to specific on security, everything from endpoint vulnerability scanning, collection of SIMs, and of course those fun government and compliance ones you even have, like your Security Pluses, DEH, et cetera. So a good little collection of all of them.
Oh, wow. That's really huge. Now, how did you venture into Virtual Armor? Or what were the paths that kind of led you to this company?
You know, it was one of those things where I'd been trying everything from security compliance to SOC analysts to security engineering and architecture. And, you know, a lot of companies don't necessarily, they may just need one particular niche of that. And when I first had my discussions with Virtual Armor, and I saw that they were a company that did specifically security. So they were one of those sort of odd niches where an individual like me with all this random experience in a field was able to take that and put it into one kind of core position where, you know, a lot of the little intangibles and side things I've done became one good, powerful position. So, you know, it was an opportunity I took a jump at, and I'm really glad I took the leap.
How long has Virtual Armor been in business? Has it been around for quite a long time?
Yeah, I believe they're coming up on about 16, 17 years total. So, even before I would have called IT security, you know, a pure industry. They've been focused largely on a lot of networking items, and security just came right along with that. So as the market matured and evolved, so did the company, seeing, you know, there was a necessity and a need here that we could absolutely fill. So, you know, they were slightly ahead of the game, and that's what matters in our field.
Excellent. Now, as a security engineer, are you involved with the actual marketing of the products and services of Virtual Armor, or you're just more of a troubleshooter interfacing the client trying to resolve their tech support issues?
You know, I tend to kind of sit around the middle. So I will oftentimes step into marketing or maybe even a sales position if it's needed for, you know, explaining some of the more technical deep dive. But a large part of my role is implementation of actual security services toward just kind of the wide variety of clients and industries that we cover. So it's a lot of times we're in there just to, you know, talking about the details of NIST compliance or PCI, and then, hey, how do we set up this sort of system and secure it in cloud and on-prem, et cetera, et cetera. So I wear quite a few hats, just like most IT folks.
Oh, wow. So have you done any work like with the CMMC or anything like that? It seems like that's now the biggest hot topic right now, I think, in cyber, because I've written a ton of white papers and blogs on it for clients just recently.
Yeah, absolutely. So SIM technology is just kind of a core technology. It's something that most companies are realizing they need to utilize to be able to ingest all the various systems, not only that are under the IT umbrella, but all the security tools that also monitor and maintain those level of operations. So I've honestly, you know, when we're doing an environment and people are asking, you know, how, what order do we do this stuff in? How should we go about this? And we start going compliance and policy and procedural needs. And we go, look, you know, you need to start with a core base. So we're happy to help with any security product, but it helps to start with SIM just because of its ability to have that sort of centralized focus on everything in an environment.
Excellent. Now, who is the typical customer base, their customer profile or sweet spot, I should say, for Virtual Armor? Is it a small to medium-sized business or Fortune 500 or perhaps a mixture of both of them?
Yeah, you know, it is a mixture of not only size of company, but of industry, of what their needs and requirements are as well. We have international companies that might be under GDPR or American company under NIST. We have everything from companies who have been hit by previous cyber attacks and need to shore up their defenses. And we have companies who see those companies and don't want to be the next target. So we've often known a pretty direct correlation between when industries get attacked. And as an IT security staff, we see the same thing. You know, if a manufacturing company gets hit and there's exploits out there, other industrial manufacturing places are surely going to get hit just because the information is out there and those systems haven't been patched. So, yeah, it's quite a unique field, and you've got to be ready to be agile and nimble.
Right. Okay, cool. Now, I'm at your website right now, and I've noticed that you have a whole wide range of services, from managed services to professional services, you know, what have you. But there's one that's kind of piqued my mind a little bit, it's Cloudcaster. Can you do a little bit of a deeper dive into that and any other services or products you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, well, same as everyone else. Everyone's getting on board with cloud right now. And what we've often noticed is that when we have these sort of security products, they are very technical looking. And even engineers at times will have trouble deciphering the data and understanding, you know, what's valuable and what's not. And oftentimes we've found that it's a lot easier, especially from sort of incident response and timekeeping and the relevant data, to have our sort of centralized portal off to the side to go, you know, this is your SIM architecture and this is the health of your systems. Just go to our site here and you're going to be able to see all your security alerts and incidents as well as what's been happening on your environment in even one more core central place. So While the interfaces for most of us IT guys are the actual systems themselves, you oftentimes need to simplify the matter and to be able to display it for everyone.
Okay, excellent. Now, do you have any customer success stories you'd like to share with us, or like anyone that you resolved a trouble, a issue ticket or something that you're really proud of and say, hey, I did this. Is there anything along, anything along those lines you'd like to share with us?
You know, every client kind of brings some of those unique stories where you're able to go back and reanalyze it and go, well, what was that about? That was interesting. Or that was a new kind of setup. To be quite honest with you, a lot of these are standard companies. You have your core but minimal IT staff who are maintaining operations, and they generally just need a hand helping out. Now, I will say there are, as I kind of alluded to earlier, there are instances where new issues are coming out that, you know, people hadn't even thought of a couple years ago. So we did notice quite a bit of uptick the last year or two for point of sale devices. And it's, again, been very interesting being on the front lines of seeing security in that, as a point of sale system has so many gaps in between it. I mean, from customer to on-site servers, to then you have to transmit to centralized data center or cloud. And then, of course, people from headquarters and other remote sites have to see that. So being able to do granular breakdowns for companies like that and go, you know, we only have limited bandwidth because this site is way out in the boonies. So to go, hey, what specific events do we need to ensure we maintain a security compliance sort of backbone, while also making sure that we're not losing data? You know, no one wants a false positive because it's a lot of clutter, but the one thing you don't want in security is, might as well be the inverse, you know, a negative, a false negative. So it's sure. Been really interesting writing policy and procedure for that sort of stuff.
Okay. Now, talking about the cloud, do you find the AWS or Microsoft Azure is being used the most by your company and or by clients?
You know, when cloud started to become incredibly popular, I think a very first jump-off point for many companies out there and individuals was utilization of, say, Office 365. Most companies, at the very least, were able to potentially migrate their Active Directory to that sort of platform. Right about the same time that all the big cloud companies started expanding, though, we did see a massive uptick in AWS, as many companies are, but we also see it in everything from, you know, Azure Cloud, IBM, Oracle. And, of course, the biggest one is that many security and software platforms themselves are going from an on-prem solution to cloud. We've been dealing with everyone from Salesforce, which is, you know, largely not an IT system, to things like Proofpoint or CrowdStrike, Carbon Black, you name it. You can just see that these companies are now realizing they're moving their infrastructure.
Right. Well, this is a topic we'll get back to later in our podcast. I think, you know, with the COVID stuff, I think a lot of companies are now realizing, you know, with the remote workforce, you know, it's probably better to have stuff in the cloud, you know, so it's easier accessible. But anyway, now, we'll move on to the meat of the show here. Now, the threat environment has really changed in the last 6 months. Now, if you asked me 1 year ago, yeah, I did hear about COVID, and I thought I was just going to stay localized in China. Never in my wildest dreams did I ever thought it would have the impacts that it's having here right now. I don't think anybody ever did. But with that in mind, how, in your view, how has this threat and the cyber threat landscape changed in the last 6 months? I mean, there's so many new cyber threats that have come out, new variants like domain name heisting, malicious spoofed websites, no longer PayPal, and it's like, you know, the World Health Organization. What are your thoughts on that? Just feel free to elaborate on that, please.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a valid question because it's something that every company and every individual in IT is dealing with right now. And I get best way I can think of it is kind of an analogy. And had you asked me as an IT security professional in January of 2020, you know, where are we at in a general sense? You know, I would have used the analogy that, you know, we're in the Wild West days, you know, we're out there, there's gunslingers and stuff. Looking now, you know, through the year's almost over, I can clearly say that while I thought we were in the Wild West days, we were clearly in the frontier. We saw minimal users out there, minimal staff, minimal applications, minimal business. There, this critical systems to people's daily lives were largely not entirely focused from a sort of remote standpoint or not online. It's that that sort of mass migration. And to me, that kind of goes, oh, now it's the Wild West. You have people's business, entire businesses, entire employee staff being put online. You have children being educated online. You have entire infrastructures now being put online. Our whole world went from kind of physical to digital in a very short amount of time. In January 2020, I would have told you, you know, we're at least 25, 30 years out from where we are right now. So it was a mad scramble sort of across the board. And with that came complications, obviously. We started noticing an immediate frequency of attack, increased frequency. We saw, you know, when everyone puts their money and their business and their information online, you're making some very juicy targets for some very smart but malicious individuals out there. We're seeing easier access to nastier tools. I mean, everyone on here can quite easily and quickly go download some security frameworks that are free. Hardware is getting incredibly cheap. Advents of things like Raspberry. You have solar charging panels. I mean, for all of this could be built for less than $100. So with that, we noticed that with the frequency of attack, it was largely network data. Where before you used to have to, as security and IT staff, largely concern yourself with more specific exploits or zero days and different attacks on infrastructure, we noticed that change went to largely network over system, and we noticed that the individual was also targeted quite a bit. It went from essentially doing a whale fishing, maybe going for specific people, to all employees are potentially a target. So between the migration of everyone and their business and information and money, to the frequency of tax and just the absolute increase in network traffic, it has been a rather not so fun year for all IT staff around the world. But we're all doing our best to kind of make up and get things back in order.
Sure. Now, I refer to bad actors as cyber attackers, but I think there's a new name for them called malicious threat actors, but whatever their name is. Are the same people doing the same things, or how is this just how the landscape has evolved since COVID-19? Because what I'm finding are fewer variants of things coming out. The existing baseline threats like phishing are still there, but they're just newer, more covert, more sophisticated forms of that coming out. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, there's always been those platforms for individuals to communicate, but with more time on individuals' hands, you know, being inside and the expansion of their ability to communicate amongst each other. And, you know, as soon as one person maybe finds an exploit in even a certain type of system in a certain type of industry, that information is propagated through that entire, we'll call them, subset of individuals that it's immediately ready for them and it's immediately able to be understood. And people from different countries that don't even speak similar languages or have similar mindsets are able to communicate and target these sort of specific little holes that can cripple entire companies or industries. I would say also what's happened is a feeding frenzy. When you have that many people, when you have that many valuable entities and companies and information out there, these hackers are getting incredibly brazen with their attitude. They are absolutely taking risks that we've never seen before. They're amplifying, they're doubling up on attacks. So doing all of this just because the payoff is just that much better. So if they're getting more intense, we kind of have to follow right along beside them.
Right. Now, one thing with the remote workforce thing that one of the trends I've noticed is, and I don't think it's really been resolved, is the meshing of the home networks with the corporate networks. So, for example, I mean, I have my own business. I don't really have, like, an employer per se, but if I had an employer, I'd probably be using my home-based router to log into, like, the corporate network. And there are a lot of threats and issues that go with that. What kind of other trends, threats are you seeing with the networks that you manage or that Virtual Armor manages?
Yeah, it's going to go right along with the increase of the attack surface, if you will. Almost immediately, we had a lot of customers that had issues with their data flow. If you've always done, you know, your ability to track how much network bandwidth, et cetera, that you're utilizing, all of a sudden putting your entire business and workforce out there and trying to remotely connect and do work to these sort of centralized internal, quote unquote, servers, our ability to notice that flow data, which is slightly different than sort of an event data, substantially increased to the point that we had several clients that needed to immediately start putting in or maybe reallocating those assets that were previously internal and make them go towards a flow capacity. I would honestly say we have historically never really had to deal with this much data before as security staff. We're having to shift up our approach from internal monitoring to not just internal monitoring, but external monitoring. So you have external users, you have external systems, and you have internal systems. So it's just we've exponentially increased the amount that we're needing to monitor, and it's been a wild ride.
Okay. Now, have you seen like a breakdown of the traditional VPNs? Because I've been reading a lot where the traditional virtual private network softwares and hardwares, they're very good, but they just cannot handle the magnitude of everybody working from home. Have you seen like any breakdowns in these kinds of systems and move towards the next virtual the next generation virtual private network or firewall?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say again, up until January, 2020 March time period, every IT department across the world has been focused on building up its internal infrastructure. And kind of as I alluded to earlier, this process was planned, but it's planned 25, 30, 40 years down the road as our society transitions that way. What happened was all those monitoring, all those alerts, all that buildup of infrastructure suddenly had to not go out the window, but be expanded upon. That it's, again, it kind of comes back to that vision. What are we looking at over here that's now just as important as what we've been building on? So having to have IT security departments expand and refocus while also having to maintain, upgrade, and build all this new area in a short amount of time has been a fun challenge for everyone involved. But again, you kind of hit on it a little bit earlier. You have individuals now at home also where before traditional IT would largely have to worry about maybe, say, mobile device management. You know, how do we take all these iPhones and Android phones and sort of standardize them, where now we're having to deal with that on even home computers. You have home monitors, routers, and modems, like you had mentioned, firewalls, all that sort of fun stuff. So trying to be able to get back to a general standardization, getting IAM back in place, proper device policies. These are all things that suddenly IT staff are having to deal with that they've never had that concern with before. So we're trying to copy sort of a lot of the procedural or policy stuff that had worked with just standard MDMN and then just expand that to carry all these new devices that are coming in. So it's been quite interesting.
Excellent. Well, my next question is about the social engineering side of things, and I'll be honest with you, in terms of that aspect, I get so many robocalls and smishing, you know, email or text messages, I just ignore 90% of calls I get these days. Tell me, how has the social engineering side of things changed with COVID? I know that's another tactic, you know, I should say more of a traditional tactic that the cyber attackers are using these days. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so again, we've noticed that we've noticed that traditional infrastructure and security, again, focused on securing firewalls and improving firewalls, systems, policies, updates, patching, et cetera, et cetera. But those systems that had billions of dollars dumped in them and some brilliant minds became almost, you know, a double-edged sword. They became so good that attackers were like, that is not worth our time to go after. And what tactics were then done was there was a pivot to, okay, well, if we can't take out this million-dollar firewall and get to stuff, how about we go after the users? And it was always, you know, there's IT security training and people understand general concepts, you know, password hygiene, you know, maybe don't use the same password across the board. But I believe the reality of those trainings are what's currently sort of hitting everyone in the face right now. People need to understand that it's no longer them just posting on various platforms, and there's a difference between work and personal life. Hackers don't care whether you're off work hours or not. If they see you have various accounts on other platforms and know that you hold the keys to something at a work environment, you are fair game over there. And again, people kind of bring that internal red flag alarm we all kind of have when they're off work hours and on personal stuff, that doesn't come up as often. So people have become the target to go after. So it's been an interesting shift.
Okay. Well, with the remote workforce, you know, there are a lot more endpoints that have been added, you know, with using personal devices and, you know, work devices and, you know, and what have you. How has this reality changed for you for doing your job?
Yeah. Again, it kind of comes back to the understanding that we have a core baseline. When in doubt, all IT security staff need to go back to kind of, I'll call it blocking and tackling. You got to go back to the basics. You have to go back to what works. And getting a corporate policy that does standardization at that level and has the ability to allow for proper device policies to be implemented, it's something that company executives and company IT staff need to work together to find a commonality and a common ground on. There's just no ability for any one company to stay on the front lines of what all the various hardware changes and updates and different stuff out there are. It's going to come down to a unified effort of business staff as well as the companies making these sorts of hardwares to come up with that standardization that we desperately need right now.
Now, so far, our podcast is focused on the people aspect of cybersecurity. Where does someone start from here?
How does someone start to get into IT security?
Oh, no. Like, what other steps can people take to protect their networks on their own? Now, obviously, the IT security team can't be at everybody's home, you know, because of privacy issues. And so what can, like, employees do on their own to protect their home networks and their corporate networks, too?
Yeah, you know, and it's never fun, but I would say it's time to refocus. The individual needs to understand that some of those IT security practices and trainings that are released are critical to how they're going to continue to do their own job moving forward. It has to be something that an individual now ingrains into their daily life to understand that the separation technology has obscured that line, that separation of work and personal life, making everything sort of fair game. People need to understand that, you know, having similar credentials across all their accounts are going to be bad. people need to understand that instead of just looking at an alert from IT or companies that they use the software of, even on a personal stance, when they send out alerts that say, you need to do this right now, that's something critical that they have to do. And if they don't, they specifically will be targeted. This is no longer something where an individual can hide behind the veil of obscurity and assume themselves to be safe. They need to know that they are being actively targeted and that they need to start being aware of that across everything they do when they touch a computer, from device to work systems.
Right. Now, we've talked about this just a little bit a while ago, like with the CCPA, GDPR, the CMMC. Compliance now is becoming one of the biggest buzzwords right now in cybersecurity. Is this something that organizations and companies need to be thinking about? In my view, I think it is, because I think once when COVID hit, the GDPR or the auditors or the enforcement body of that, they kind of didn't levy any financial penalties. But I think they're now starting to pick up on that now that they realize the remote workforce is going to be with us for quite some time. Is this something that we need to all be more cognizant about, that companies need to be more they need to come to the realization, hey, I need to be compliant so I don't get audited or have 4% of my revenues being taken away from for financial penalties if I fail an audit?
Yes. The answer is shortly yes. I would say even companies that don't have direct requirements for business or IT security compliance still need to start looking at these frameworks. They still, you need to go look at this to understand a baseline of how security is going to operate in your company. And when you do get these new technologies or new hardwares or new attacks or new staff even, you have the ability to fall back on that framework to know what you're going to do in the future. Now, I will say a lot of companies that are required to get some level of government compliance for their business, they tend to get themselves into a bit of trouble. They lose sight of actual security practices in order to potentially pass their audit and compliance. So to put that bluntly, just because you're compliant in a security framework does not mean you are secure. There isn't a checkbox, and you go, hey, great, we're compliant. But we've noticed that individual companies that have that sort of compliance requirement and only care about getting that box checked are the ones that are actually making themselves more insecure. So I had thought about this a little bit before, and I wanted to kind of give you a good example. And one we had seen was Network Time Protocol, NTP, right? So if you've done NIST compliance, you are well familiar with network time. It's just making sure all your systems are synced up across the network, right? Make sure there aren't replay attacks, stuff like that. Well, we started ingesting the logs from these systems, and we started looking, and we noticed that every single system in this company was talking out to random public addresses over NTP port. And so we go to the IT staff, we go, hey, why is every system in your company talking out to random public IPs? What is that about? And they go, well, we had a requirement to do NTP setup. So we just went through and we turned on NTP across every single system. And it's one of those where we kind of were like, okay, well, yes, you technically adhered to exactly what the NIST compliance requirement was. However, what you did was you just opened up every single system to a random public IP address. You poked a tiny little hole in every system throughout your network. So it's one of those situations where we had to go to them and go, yes, again, you are compliant. Here is how we actually need to architect the whole thing, that we need to have centralized NTP server. It's internal and have all these other systems talk to that. That way we can kind of, well, quote unquote, crown jewel that device, double the monitoring, but cut it down to, instead of every single system, a centralized one. So again, compliance is such a broad and complicated field. It's one where even security staff attempting to be compliant can inadvertently make themselves more insecure. So definitely something to keep an eye out for, and it's constantly changing. So it's one of those fun ones in town that you always got to see how attacks are occurring, how business operate, and then how compliance could be properly implemented to actually give security.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I've written a bunch of things for clients at the CMMC. My gosh, that thing is so confusing. Anyway, okay, now, a lot of these conversations, you know, that I have with people, or when I read the major news headlines every night, they seem to be going, like, in one direction. Do this, do that, here's a checklist. How do you spur people to become proactive, and how do you get them to connect with other people, other businesses, to share intel, you know, to become more proactive? It seems like we still live in reactive times when it comes to cybersecurity, even with the advent of COVID-19. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, I suppose the best way I could describe it is that IT security as an emerging industry has thus far been existing on these little islands. Where each company has their own resources, and if they learn something about, you know, through trial of fire that has occurred to their organization, they internalize it. They become sort of tribal knowledge, if you will. That inability to act like our adversaries and have these wide communication platforms where we go, look, you may be a business competitor of ours. You know, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't share information. And that's what it comes down to. We need to understand that IT security is what we're all involved in. The business lines don't matter when it comes to this level of information. And I'll be honest with you, it isn't until the collaboration began, IT organizations were largely able to defend themselves against these global attacks. But again, if our adversaries spread out, if they are sharing information in a certain way and getting these things out there, we need to do the exact same thing. We need to go out there, like-minded peers, regardless of business, regardless of industry, and begin sharing what we're seeing, sharing tactics that worked, showing signatures, holes that were bad, exploits that were bad, potentially bad configurations. And until that happens, we're going to continue to get out-communicated by our adversaries. So it's one of those things that needs to be sort of centrally managed. Someone needs to take the reins of that and begin those sort of discussions.
Well, do you think it's the role of the CISO or the CIO to be doing it? Because, I mean, it seems like, you know, everything should come from I don't know whether it's correct or not. I'm not taking a position. But it seems like that the CIO or the CISO should really take initiative to get these lines of communication established and figured out. Because once an employee sees, hey, my boss is doing this, and his boss says, well, my CIO is doing this, that's going to lead more by example. What are your thoughts on that? Are you seeing more of that where these basically, is the C-suite doing a better job of communicating IT security downwards to their employees? That's really what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, so the model generally from executive level, the CISOs and the CIOs, have generally largely been focused on the business level. They're not, other than potentially a massive red flag that comes before them, going to get into that granular technical level. What it's going to take are for the guys in the middle, the guys where the rubber meets the road, everything from the analysts to the engineers to the architects, going and pushing their own internal management to start having those conversations created, to start telling them, look, you got to reach out to our, you know, business competition, and you need to set up something because we need to know what they know and they need to know what we know. So while it may be the responsibility of those executives, I don't believe they're going to know what needs to be transmitted. So it's going to have to be a team effort there, the executive management with IT staff to get that communication open.
Okay. Now, when it comes to cybersecurity sales, you know, like a business development representative trying to, you know, pitch a product, you know, fear is one of the biggest tactics that they can use and do it very successfully with that. But now, is this environment, how much of it is actually fear-based selling versus actual products and solutions that people really need? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, and this will even go back to my time before security engineer. I've never been a part of an MSP. I was always internal IT staff at some sort of level. And over the years, I've heard just about every kind of sales pitch on every kind of IT software out there. And then you get to be a part of it. And how you referred to it as the fear-based selling, that it's so old school. It's behind its times, its legacy. Anyone focused on fear-based selling clearly doesn't know their market. The IT staff out here that are running these organizations are smart. They know what the 0 days are. They know what their flaws are. They don't want to be told, hey, your company's going to be crippled and you're going to be out of a job. You better buy our software. It was right about February or March. For the very first time in my career, I took on some sales engineering sort of responsibilities. And I once again started seeing both from ourselves and others this focus on this fear-based selling, and said, no, this can't be right. This what we need to do is actually point out with our expertise as we label ourselves and say, you have problems here, and you know you have problems here. Let us help you fix it. Let us be that sort of voice, that shield out there. Instead of cowering, feel free to go about and do what you do because we have this. And I noticed that's not something even my own company, but all companies need to start doing. It's time for our industry as a whole to mature. We need to stop scaring people and going, look, you need to be focused on this. You need to know it's happening, but we are here to protect you and make that sort of change. We need to show that we are the masters of this sort of thing. So it's been a nice, interesting time to be in a revolutionary sort of emerging field and be on the front lines of seeing that shift from the fear-based selling, as you say, to actually what a company can do and how they can secure you.
Okay, excellent. Now, when the big hacks happen, you know, I think the most recent one was with Twitter. Why does it really matter? I mean, is it just the news outlets that are just hyping this thing up, or is it really something that's actually happened? And, like, will my Twitter account be hacked into? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Similar back to that obscuring of the lines between work and privacy, to use your example, Twitter there. A real hacker is not going to care about your Twitter handle. They don't care how many letters they could go in and mess with you. What they are going to care about is what your credentials on one platform or one system, what those can get to. It's about lateral movement. So do they care, how your dog looks this morning? No, they don't. What they care about is getting your bank account. Excuse me. Now, in tandem with that, I would say, you know, viruses have always sort of been a historic issue for us, the spread of viruses, that sort of thing. It's getting better and better due to technology. And viruses, like individuals, are going to take the easiest route forward. So, to come back to it, if your social media accounts are something that you very much do not concern yourself with the security, with credential hygiene, with multi-factor authentication, that's how they're going to get you. They're not, you may have the strongest password, but if they can get to one particular system and pivot, that's exactly what they're going to do. So people just need to be aware that all of their online presence is potentially game for these people.
Right. I think one thing to note too, Garrett, is that, you know, the cyber attackers not just doing what they call the traditional smash and grab campaigns. They're not like launching brute force dictionary attacks to get as many passwords as possible. They're just taking their own sweet time. They're selecting a few targets, a few victims, and taking their own sweet time to build up their profile and seeing where the weak spots are at. And I think once they find one, they just go in and stay in for as long as they can, right?
Oh, absolutely. It just shows kind of the depth of the complication of our field, and that we have to, as IT staff and IT security staff, we have to cover every single door at all times. And if there's even one weak point, that's where we'll get hit, where our adversaries can sit and wait. They can study, they can monitor, they can see how people interact. And what they're going to do is they're going to wait till the perfect moment. You know, they're going to wait till 5 a.m. on Christmas, and they're going to hit you on a system that you have the least staff on, and they're going to know exactly what kind of program it is and what patch level. And it kind of comes down to social media. People don't realize, you know, if you go to LinkedIn right now and you type in a company and you type in IT after the company, you're going to see staff there. And even if they don't, there might be a few on there who have the systems they've worked on, or previous employees that have worked on staff. And what these hackers are doing, and they're just sitting and mining. They got a notepad right beside them, and they're going, oh, well, hey, at this company and current employees and previous, we see that their endpoint program is this, and they have worked on this kind of SIM before. That gives us a pretty accurate description of what to attack. And so, yeah, those hackers' ability to just sit back and wait till you are at your absolutely weakest before they attack, that right there is the biggest complication in our field right now.
Well, Garrett, another thing I kind of found too is that, you know, the big target are the web applications. I mean, companies think just because they're using the most secure, you know, VM on the AWS or on Azure, they're not going to get hit. But where I think a lot of people fail is that software developers don't test for the security of the source code, especially when it comes to using APIs from, you know, third-party libraries. They don't really test that code. And a lot of backdoors are actually, I think, are left open in that regards too. The next thing is, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, kind of having those external doors and not just web applications or programming, but IoT, if you will, you know, all these devices out there, when programs and devices and hardware and the whole gambit are being created, it's clear, as you kind of said, that security is not in the mind of the people engineering, marketing, and selling this stuff. It needs to now be a situation where you don't release software, you don't release hardware unless it meets certain requirements. They're very clearly being targeted because of their lack of it. And so, again, we need to kind of get back to that base level standardization, not just at a business level, but on a national level, and say, you need to have this before you can release this to the general public.
Excellent one. Now, in what scenarios do breaches really matter to individuals? So, for example, like me, what should I be concerned about if I hear about a cyber attack in the news?
Yeah. So an individual, we see them all the time, you know, social security numbers have gone out, or credit card information, et cetera, et cetera. It's that level, again, it comes down to base IT security. It comes down to your blocking and tackling. You need to have individuals that understand that their password cannot be the same across all the systems. And as much of the extra step as it takes, things like multi-factor authentication are absolutely vital to both individual and business protection. These are, you know, someone whose, you know, password is gone over there, suddenly their account is being used to crack all the accounts across there. Where a simple mechanism like MFA or changing what password you use would have relieved their, you know, their headaches right there, and it would have been a non-starter.
Yeah, well, in that regard, Garrett, what role what's the position of Virtual Armor on the Zero Trust framework? I mean, it's like a new methodology. I think a lot of companies are now starting to, or at least are thinking about embracing. Has Virtual Armor taken that approach, or are they thinking about it, or what are your thoughts on that?
You know, the concept is great. I think no one individual or one individual account, maybe more to be more specific, should be able to cripple and give away the keys to a kingdom. The ability to have built-in redundancy checks from a policy and procedural standpoint, I think they're great. I think it's nothing but a win for our industry. Just the ability to go, okay, you do have access to this. Let's make sure, you know, we're watching when you're utilizing that account and, you know, then doing subsequent auditing and maybe make sure that this one specific account isn't touching domain controllers and DNS servers and yada, yada down the line. So I think it's a way, it's a step in the correct direction. Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we come to the last part of our show here, I just want to ask you a few questions on just some of the more pressing, I think, hot topics that are out there right now. And these are just general questions, not company specific, so just feel free to elaborate your thoughts on them. One thing is the Internet of Things. You know, that's where basically everything's connected in the virtual and physical worlds. I think it's a very scary proposition. I hate having all this interconnectivity going on. I don't have a smart car. I don't have a smartphone. I mean, I still use an analog old 03 Honda Civic. I mean, do you have a smart home or a smart car? Or if you clap your hands, your car backs up, your coffee machine starts, anything like that? Or what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I have found a unique pattern in that most IT and IT security staffers will stay away from that level of smart technology. And I don't think it's because we're naturally smarter or have some sort of, you know, thought against it. I think what you're seeing is a people who understand technology and understand security. And if they are without any sort of, you know, mass communication, all just seeming to decide to keep that out of their homes, keep that out of their cars and out of their lives, I think that's a big wake up call for everyone else. I think there's absolutely no reason that any IT security staffer would want a microphone in their home, that they would want additional holes to get into their systems through their coffee maker. You know, I think it, again, it's a pattern that has emerged without any sort of unified communication, which means it's the reality of the situation. And individuals need to look at that and understand that they are opening themselves up to these sort of attacks and should probably follow a bit of the lead of the individuals who are working with this stuff daily.
Excellent. Now, artificial intelligence, I just finished writing a book on that. It's going to be coming out in print in February. AI is like one of the biggest buzzwords right now in cybersecurity, and that's what it really is. It's just a buzzword. I think a lot of people still fail to really understand what it's about. When it relates to cybersecurity, I think the two biggest uses are for like threat – I mean, not threat, but I mean more for like automation and pen testing exercises. And filtering for the false positives so that only the real ones will show up in your SIM system. What are your thoughts on AI? Is Virtual Armor using the stuff in their own products and services?
You know, AI, as you kind of said, is a good buzzword, but it is good technology, and that's why it's been propagating. I think at the moment, it's still not fully matured and developed. So what you're seeing is IT staffers try to use this new sort of theory on how to use this technology in order to help themselves. And as you said, for pen testing, for things where a computer is too processed, a computer doesn't have that sort of quote-unquote intelligence to make a unique decision on the fly, that's situations where AI could be a great boon. I think right now there is still a lot of unknown, as you kind of said about it. I think a lot of individuals are unsure, even if they have a knowledge, how they could apply that to business cases, how they could apply that to their business processes as well. So I feel like we're going to see a change in AI towards using AI to do remediation of things, simple tasks. You know, we obviously there are already sort of like SOAR platforms. There are already automated platforms out there that will go, you know, if this happens, then go do this. But I think this is where AI could be big, where we go, okay, do this if this happens. Well, the system might go, oh, they're broke or there's unique data. And that's that little tiny sliver where AI could be a huge boon and shore up a process that used to break quite a bit.
Okay, excellent. Now, another question I want to ask you is about cybersecurity insurance. Have you had any, like, clients or anything ask you about that, or does Virtual Armor offer any kind of programs? I mean, being, like, more in a managed service provider area, what do they offer, or is Virtual Armor thinking about doing something like that? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, Virtual Armor does not. I have worked at previous companies that, as internal IT, who have obtained security insurance. You're going to get a biased answer here. As a security engineer, that, in my opinion, security insurance means you know you're going to fail. And that's a mindset that's hard to overcome moving forward. That said, we all know the realities. You can act and you could cover all your bases and you could be incredibly diligent, and you might still get popped. And that's one of those situations where, you know, as a sort of a philosophical thought, is should we have had the insurance? Boy, maybe we should have. But, you know, there are certain times where you have to start implementing risk management. You need to understand, do we need to cover every single employee in our business, or do we need to cover key areas? So I could certainly see where security insurance on maybe specific applications, softwares, or systems would be a great boon. But at its current iteration, I would need to see it develop a bit more before I would actively tell companies that they need to have that.
Okay, excellent. Now, again, you know, COVID-19 and the remote workforce, we touched on this before, but how has it changed? If we haven't talked about this before in other aspects, what do you think the dynamics of the remote workforce are going to be next year in terms of the cybersecurity threat landscape now that everybody's going to be working from home? I think this is not going to be the new normal. I think the days of going to traditional brick-and-mortar office are now pretty much over. How is this going to change the threat landscape, and how is it going to change your role, you know, being an IT security engineer? How do you see things changing in 2021?
Always good to look forward on this stuff. I believe looking forward, when things have become a little more standardized for this new sort of, as you said, normalcy that we're dealing with, people are going to begin understanding that they do need to do these sort of base security items. They do need to do password and MFA. I think companies are going to start realizing that they absolutely have to do additional network and security monitoring. They can no longer simply rely on not being noticed. The technology has gotten too good, and they have too big of an imprint out on the net. What was the concept? It's officially called what? Security through obscurity. That is how it is changing. That is, people are going to need to understand that they are no longer obscure. They are out there with a big old sign flashing and pointing down at them going, hey, here I am, and I'm holding a whole lot of money and a whole lot of information in business. And I think people are now realizing that we weren't quite ready to put our entire way of life out there, and it's time to start making those adjustments. How do we not only maintain productivity, but increase productivity, and not just IT, but in business with this new normalcy? And I think by utilizing different security softwares for not only security purposes, but for business purposes as well, it is really where the landscape of our field is going to go. I truly believe that IT will be seen soon from what was a cost center to being an integral part of business, and potentially something that could even be used to save a company money in other departments, in other areas, and potentially even make a company money if properly utilized.
Excellent. Now, Gert, as we now wrap up our show, I guess we'll say the best for last. We all are at risk of becoming a victim of a cyber attack. You know, it can happen to any of us. But what do you tell people like family, friends, clients, what they can do to mitigate that risk from happening? In other words, how do you tell them to decrease those statistical odds of becoming a victim of news headlines? Do you have a laundry list of items you tell people?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to beat that drum because it is my goal in life to make sure everyone gets things. And you've heard me say it, and I'll say it again. MFA has to be done. Taking from a single point, a single type of password that can be used to something that is random and more in control of an individual or company takes just that one more gateway away from a malicious individual. Again, I'm banging the drum here, but network and security monitoring. What is the point in having all these fancy firewalls and fancy IDS, IPS, endpoint programs, you name it, if it's going to do alarm overload, alarm fatigue, alert fatigue, right? The ability to see all of that stuff is going to be crucial to a business. You have to have centralized management. And the last thing I would say would pertain to both the individual as well as companies out there. The security through obscurity is gone. That is no longer a world we live in. If you assume that you are out there talking anonymously, you need to know that you're already wrong. You need to understand that you are potentially a target just because of what you know.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Garrett, we thank you for your time this morning. It's definitely an insightful podcast. I don't think I've really interviewed a security engineer before, so this is really a thought-provoking podcast. We thank you for your time, and I hope to have you again on future shows.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Take care. Hey, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Bye-bye.